Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 326, for Friday, December 22nd, 2017. Dr. Nigel Cameron. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by GoToWebinar, a trusted webinar platform with over 55,000 customers who have hosted over 2.7 million interactive web events to connect with their audiences. For more, visit gotowebinar.com/podcast. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we bring the luminaries, the people responsible for guiding us into the future of tech and the future of humanity, and we talk to them. We try to get their knowledge into the minds of the TWiT audience. I'm Father Robert Balasair, and today we've got a special guest for you. He is the president of the Center for Policy on Emerging Technology, a think tank in Washington, D.C. that he co-founded back in 2007. He is the technology and futures editor at unheard.com. Now, he has represented the United States as part of various delegations to the United Nations, General Assembly, and UNESCO, and is currently in his fourth term as commissioner of the U.S. National Commission. He has testified before the U.S. Congress, the European Parliament, and the European Commission's Group on Ethics in Science and Technology. He has a distinguished speaking career that has taken him from the Global Health Forum to the Aspen Ideas Festival to the Middle East Tech Conference to TED and The Economist. It's Dr. Nigel Cameron. Dr. Cameron, thank you very much for coming onto the Triangulation.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Now, let's dive into your past just a bit, just so that our audience can get to know you. You have this wonderful confluence of academic endeavors that stretch from technology to theology. Tell me about your background. How did you come to be who you are today?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? I think looking back, I can make a certain amount of sense of it. Looking forward, of course, it's always another matter. You're making jumps from lily pad to lily pad. But I mean, I began in my teens, interestingly. My original plan was to go into British politics. And so I had a keen interest in policy from the get-go. And then I decided instead to study religion, which I did at Cambridge and Edinburgh, and philosophy and some ethics. And soon enough, I got into bioethics. And it was pretty young. I mean, back in the late 70s and the early 80s, particularly the bioethics implications of new technologies, you know, in vitro fertilization, cloning was on the horizon, all sorts of things like that. And so there was a trajectory there which got me more into the policy arena for technology. And it was around 2000 I decided that if you talk about ethics, who comes to your meetings? Ethicists. Talk about policy, you get the grown-ups coming, you get people in the capital, you know, global capital markets, investment community, tech gurus, policymakers. And when you talk about technology, you're always talking about values. And so I sort of refocused myself really on the policy implications of all of these quite dramatic changes in technology. That's a quick version. I did an MBA along the way, which kind of makes my PhD look a little less interesting to people. So they don't think, oh, he must be an academic. You know, what's he doing at our policy meeting or our business meeting? And that was quite a useful exercise because I learned a lot about how business people look at the world.
It's interesting because some people may look at your background and wonder about, wow, that's a really diverse academic interest. I don't think that because that's kind of what my religious order does all the time. I'm actually a Jesuit, so we do that in spades. But looking back through your academic distinguishments over the years, you can almost see that bend away from theology, away from philosophy, into politics and sociology. In 1990, you were the Distinguished Professor of Theology and Culture at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. But then in 2016, you were the Fulbright Visiting Research Chair in Science and Society at the University of Ottawa, Canada. So there is that wonderful taking one field and putting it together with another field that people don't think belong together. So I have to ask, what does theology have anything to do with science, technology, society, and politics?
Well, I spend most of my time working with people who are totally secular, and I think the meeting point is the concern about values. I mean, obviously, religious people, Christians. I mean, I'm a Presbyterian, a mainline Presbyterian from Scotland, which of course is where Presbyterianism takes its home. But ultimately, we're talking about the values of the human community. And I suppose one thing that someone coming from a religious background brings to this discussion particularly is the notion that technology actually isn't about technology. Technology is about people. It's about the human community. It's about those who use it, those who find advantage in it or disadvantage. It's essentially a humanist thing. And recognizing that, I think, is the point at which, you know, we can move forward. I mean, the people take very different views of technology. Of course, the so-called Luddites want to tear it all down, very suspicious of it. Others rather naively believe it will save us all from everything, and technology is the answer. I think there's a lot of middle ground there. And I think coming from a Christian tradition, I think one has a sort of way of framing these issues. Yes, we believe God wants us to use science and technology, but no, we believe he has other interests too, which are focused around the dignity of the individual, human rights, and human flourishing. I think if we can put the pieces together, then we have a baseline on which to build the future.
Oh, I'm with you. That's absolutely the worldview that I have when I try to combine my faith and technology, my passion for technology. But we do have members of our audience who will say, wait a minute. Technology has a relational aspect, and they won't believe it because technology for them is technology. It's a tool. It's something that we created. It doesn't necessarily have to be connected to a human community. It doesn't say anything about the human communities that use them. How do you make the argument that technology is a relational thing, that the tools that we build and we develop aren't just tools, but they actually interact with who we are as a people?
Well, perhaps the best example of this is, of course, Facebook and Mr. Zuckerberg. And in fact, we just finished writing a long piece on Mark Zuckerberg at unheard.com. And I spent the last few months thinking and writing about Facebook. And it really interests me that on the one hand, this is a platform. It's the ultimate, the most significant of all these technological products of the last 30 years for 2 billion people around worldwide using it every month. At the same time, and of course, this is something that Zuckerberg himself keeps saying, it's all about relationships. He's bringing people together. I mean, we call it social media. And so rather curiously, the most significant achievements of technology so far have been to set up new ways in which people can relate to each other. Now, I mean, I'm not naive about how wonderful that is. I think it does all sorts of strange things when you start relating to people through technologies which have their own values, their own shape, and their own norms. But it seems to me it's interesting that social media is the thing that most strikes most people when technology is on the horizon. So, I mean, because the great odd thing is that they sit there using their mobile phones to chat to their friends while ignoring the friends who happen to be across the table from them. And that's the kind of challenge we face now, is putting these things together in a way so that there's a net benefit rather than a net disbenefit from our application of the technology. But ultimately, it is about people. And I think if you frame it as being about people, and you're always asking the people question, the human question, then perhaps we can get it right.
All right, I'm definitely going to come back to that in a bit, but I do want to dive into your latest book. You are the author of Will Robots Take Your Job? It's a plea for consensus. Now, I went through this book about a week ago, and then I went through it again last night just because it touches on so many topics that I think are a cause of fear in modern society. Specifically, well, the title says it all, Will Robots Take Your Job? Will the development of technology and increasingly advanced smart technologies make work obsolete? I'm not going to spoil it. We're not going to jump too far ahead. You obviously have some very strong feelings about what it means to have smart technologies take over. But why do you think this is a reemerging fear now? I mean, we can go back to the Industrial Revolution. We can go back to the Luddites to show what happens when people fear that machines are taking their jobs. But it feels different this time, doesn't it? I mean, compared to, say, the Industrial Revolution, the smart AI revolution or the IT revolution has a different flavor to it that I think makes people really think that now they are in risk of losing their jobs, losing their livelihoods.
I think there are two different questions here. One is, to take seriously, if you like, the notion that this is just another industrial revolution. It's a big one, but we've had them before, and therefore it'll all be okay in the end of the day. I think that's one question, and I think that question isn't at all as comfortable as people tend to think who answer like that. I think you dig into what really happened during the industrial revolution, and you find there was enormous dislocation. And you look back to more recent industrial revolutions, and whether you want to go to Detroit or to Gary, Indiana, which was once an extraordinarily prosperous community 100 years ago, you know, named after the guy who ran U.S. Steel, and every other year is now the homicide capital of the U.S. Of course, Detroit with its water. Or you go to Britain, look at South Wales, the destruction of the mining industry, you know, Clydeside and shipbuilding. I mean, these things that we actually did do in the past that in the long term was successful were in fact enormously costly for communities, for individuals. Generation would often lose its jobs and they just never get another one. So I think it doesn't do to be glib, even if what's happening now is essentially the same as happened before. Particularly what's happening now, even if we do get all sorts of new jobs and things just carry on with a full employment economy, as people are generally assuming, what we're going to see is what I call rust belts sort of breaking out right across the economy. There won't be one rust belt. There'll be rust belts in retail, rust belts in law, rust belts in psychology, in counseling, rust belts, you know, obviously in driving. And these things will happen, you know, within the same time because they're all based on the same technologies. So I think even if you take the view that in the end of the day, things will settle down, people will still have jobs, I think it's going to be a very rough journey from here to there. Labor markets are going to be in turmoil, I think, of historic proportions on a good reading of things. But then, of course, secondly, there's the other question, which is whether things might not settle down, which is whether, in fact, there's a fundamental shift taking place here. And that essentially what AI is doing is shifting labor out of the market. That is to say, capital substituting for labor in the production of value. We've had some very striking examples of this. I mean, perhaps the most dramatic of all is the story of Kodak and Instagram. It's the one that I go around telling. And of course, it's an outlier case, but it is quite dramatic. When Kodak was in their heyday as the dominating global photography, Kodak Corporation itself had 145,000 people working for it, plus gazillions more in Photoshops all over the world. When Instagram was taken over, it had 13 people working for it, 1-3. And Instagram, of course, is now, you know, how we think about photography. So, I mean, that's quite dramatic. And it shows basically the substitution of a digital product for an analog, a real-world product. But I think if that is the kind of thing that's going to go on, if we're going to see labor basically being pushed out, capital coming in instead, then it's a fundamental shift. And the whole notion of the industrial economy, the notion of full employment as a norm is one which may just go away. And what's particularly disturbing is the studies are suggesting that the impact could be worse in developing economies, where for all sorts of reasons, the sort of civil society implications are much more dramatic because they haven't got an infrastructure to, you know, unemployment benefit and other social benefits and civil society organizations to keep things on track when people don't have jobs. But I think those are two different questions. And I think the answer to either of them raises problems. And I think I'm not saying it's likely we're going to end up with there being basically no jobs or very few jobs altogether. But that's a risk issue we have to look at.
I get the fact that there are different types of disruption. You bring this up in your book, and you also bring this up in your TED Talk. This idea that there's a disruption that then normalizes. Maybe people get shifted around in industries, but you essentially create more jobs, you create more progress, you create more profit centers. There's another type of disruption, and this is the one that people are always afraid is around the corner, where things get changed and you have no place. And it gets changed to the point where you now have to rethink how the society is oriented around its production, around its work. But you always have people. I know you've had naysayers in the past who will say, wait a minute. People like you, futurists, people who talk about the replacement of work, always get this wrong. You were wrong in the Industrial Revolution. You were wrong in all the mini revolutions that we've had since then. We've always come out the other side of the disruption with more jobs, with more profit, with more production. What is it specifically about this revolution, about this disruption, that you think is going to make it different? I mean, we have the example of Kodak, which is mind-boggling, from 145,000 to 13. But what else is there specifically about the changes that we've seen in technology that you think are going to upheave society?
Well, I look around me and I look for people who are thinking about these things, and I try to listen to what they're saying. And the reason I wrote the book and the reason I become concerned about this issue isn't because it's something on which I claim any unique expertise. It's because I look around me and see people in leadership positions all the way from the labor unions to governments who do not want to address the issue at all. They really don't want to do that. And so far as I'm aware, there's been only one speech by a major political leader in the West addressing this issue. And it was just a few weeks ago, in fact, by the British socialist leader, Jeremy Corbyn. He just picked up this in a conference speech, and I commend him for it. But they don't. I mean, I sat through every single one of the presidential debates. I mean, the whole thing. I deserve, we all deserve a medal if we did that. Every single, not one line about this question. And when people are not talking about, not thinking about, not prepared to make plans, contingency plans, look at this as a risk issue, I think we should get pretty scared. So I bet that's part of my approach here. But then so I look around and I say, well, where are there the people who are outspoken and who are prepared to say things that don't fit? And for example, Bill Gates has been talking about this for a long time. And he knows a thing or two about technology and about business. And he says things like governments will be pleading with businesses to employ people rather than machines in the future. Another example is Larry Summers. Of course, Larry Summers is not given for keeping his mouth shut and, you know, being tactful and being shy. I mean, and we need people like, because he says what he thinks. And he's made a very interesting lecture 2 or 3 years ago where he said that when he was at MIT as a student, he said there were two groups of people talking about this. There were the smart people who said it was all going to be okay. And then his phrase is, there were the stupid Luddite people. And they were saying it would not be okay. And he now thinks the stupid Luddite people may have been right. And a third example is that of Charles Murray. Somewhat less well-known, but a very significant major conservative intellectual here in the United States. And he gave a lecture at the American Enterprise Institute, you know, which is Washington's big pro-business think tank, published it in the Wall Street Journal, not a sort of typical Luddite location for, to make this sort of case. And he said something like, it's very hard to believe in 20 years' time that most people will be earning the sort of living they are now. And so he was making a case for what's called basic universal income. The idea that everybody should be paid a kind of social security payment so that people can come in and out of jobs, people can have part-time jobs. There's much less dramatic impact on their lives and, of course, on demand within the economy of there being many fewer jobs. So, I mean, here we have people across the spectrum who are outliers, but who are suggesting we've got a big problem here and people in authority aren't prepared to look at it. And so what I'm concerned to do is to try to raise the profile of this question and get people in government and even people within the labor movement to take this more seriously. We don't know what's going to happen. I think it's pretty sure in terms of my sort of question number one, we're going to have big, big disruption. And that's on the cards. I mean, I think it's very hard to believe in 20 years' time there'll be any trucks on freeways being driven by people. I mean, there are some pretty obvious things here that most people agree about. And the top job for men in the U.S. is truck driving. 3.5 million or something American men drive trucks. If none of them has a job as a truck driver, you know, these aren't people who are going to retrain to be, you know, run robot factories or whatever the new jobs are going to be. But then secondly, we have this threat that, in fact, the jobs may just not come back. And even if that's just a sort of one chance in 20, well, I mean, you know, you buy fire insurance for your house, even if you're pretty sure it's never going to burn down, and very few houses do burn down, we've got to be looking at preparing for what might be the case if we run out of jobs.
I'd love to discuss that, because we're now getting into this idea of, well, how do we react to this? How do we plan for this? How do we ask our leaders to have these very difficult conversations? In fact, before we take a break, I do want to bring up the fundamental question that was part of your TED Talk in 2014. You said, will this be the century that it will be best known for the triumph of technology, or will it be the century that is marked by the triumph of humanity? Another way of saying that is, will technology enhance and enable the flourishing of humanity, or will it be something darker and more sinister. Would you mind if we spoke about that when we come back? Fantastic. I'm speaking with Dr. Nigel Cameron. He is the author of Will Robots Take Your Job? We're going to look at some of the issues involved with the disruption caused by technology in society and perhaps take a sneak peek into what a future society that is led by advanced computers, advanced intelligence, might look like. We'll be right back with our interview, but first let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, this episode of Triangulation is brought to you by GoToWebinar. It's the webinar platform that's hosted 2.7 million interactive web events with over 60 million views per year. GoToWebinar believes that webinars are one of the best ways to interact with your prospects and customers. They know that PowerPoint presentations and bulk spam email don't work. They don't want you to do the traditional business presentations or company websites. They want something that's a bit more interactive, something that's more engaging. They want GoToWebinar. Now, with GoToWebinar, you can create custom email invitations, confirmations, and reminders, or let GoToWebinar handle it for you with automated email templates. You can display your company logo and custom image in all webinar materials, create and schedule pre-recorded webinars that are as interactive as live events, and you can do everything via your mobile device. It's mobile-friendly. You can schedule a webinar, edit a session, or track performance from your iOS or Android device. It allows you to create up to 20 polls before the session or do them on the fly for audience interaction. You can add up to 20 questions to a survey and engage participants with Q&A. You can engage your audience with more than one presenter and panelists. In fact, you can have up to 6 presenters who can share their webcams and participate face-to-face. You can broadcast a view of your desktop or a specific application, which means you get to show your customers, your prospects, exactly what they need to see so that they walk away with more knowledge. And with GoToWebinar's reporting and analytics, you're just a click away from qualified leads, metrics, and data to improve your webinars. You'll have end-to-end 128-bit AES encryption and a service that's rated number one in customer satisfaction. So, if you want to do more with your next presentation, turn it into a conversation with GoToWebinar. For more information, visit gotowebinar.com/podcast. That's gotowebinar.com/podcast. And we thank GoToWebinar for their support of Triangulation. We are speaking with Dr. Nigel Cameron. He is the author of Will Robots Take Your Job? We're talking a little bit about disruption. This is one of these words that gets bandied about in the Silicon Valley all the time. Disruption is good. You want to be disruptive because disruption typically leads to greater profits. But there's a different kind of disruption that you describe both in your book and in your TED Talk that takes away jobs. Now, just briefly before the break, you spoke about this, the industry of truck drivers in the United States. It is one of the biggest employers of American men. We have trucks going across the country every single day, millions and millions of drivers. And you made a bold claim, which is in 10 years, there will be no truck drivers. What's this based on?
Well, I think I probably said 20, but I mean 10 is entirely possible. And you know, the self-driving car discussion has been quite fascinating. There was a book by a pair of academics, which is quite influential, came out about maybe 12 or 13 years ago. And one of the things they said was something we can be quite sure of is that in our, you know, there's no foreseeable possibility in our generation of machines being able to drive because it's so complicated. And they specifically gave the example, you know, of making a turn against traffic. Because there are just so many factors involved. And yet within just 2 or 3 years of that, DARPA, the government agency that looks at all these technologies and pushes them forward, was having a competition to encourage the development of self-driving cars. And now it's these things have been tested on the roads. And although we aren't quite there yet. I mean, the U.S. government, governments around the world are making regulations now so that it's possible for them to be road tested and ultimately rolled out. So I think most people agree now that we are going to get self-driving vehicles, and it will probably begin with trucks because the costs are so much higher. I mean, you can get 24-hour operation, the insurance costs are higher, trucks are very dangerous things, and certainly the freeway driving truck component is a relatively easy thing. It's very different if you're having people doing deliveries or going around little country roads. But in fact, and in Europe, they've begun something called platooning, which the European Union is very keen on, where you have one driver in one truck, and there may be 20 trucks behind, all connected by Wi-Fi, with no drivers. And they've been doing experiments with that. So, I mean, there are various ways this is going to happen. But I remember talking to AFL-CIO, you know, which is the organization of U.S. labor unions, about this several years ago. I was talking to one of their people on the phone, and I said, doesn't this worry you? And he was saying, no, we're pro-innovation. It's happened before. It's all okay. And I said, who there is working on this question? He said, so far as I know, nobody. There's nobody specifically working on the issue of jobs and robots. And I said, well, maybe you should all sort of stop what you're doing and you should all work on it. Because what happens if in 15, 20 years' time, the Teamsters, I mean, have no members? And I think that's entirely possible. The point is, it isn't that machines are all that brilliant, but humans are terrible drivers. And it's interesting, you know, that if you track these things, but the number of deaths on U.S. roads is going up. It went down gradually for many, many, many years. And 3 or 4 years ago, 32,000 people were killed on the roads in the U.S. It's now 40,000. It's gone up by 25% over about 3 years. And one of the cards which is being played by those who favor self-driving vehicles is that they will be a lot safer. Now, I think if things go wrong, someone hacks the self-driving system and gets 1,000 cars to misbehave. I mean, there are plenty of negatives here, and I'm not unduly optimistic about this being an easy process. But humans are terrible drivers. We have enormous numbers of accidents. And if we go self-driving for trucks, if we go self-driving within the cities, you know, basically Uber, the Uber comes to your front door with no driver. It saves Uber a lot of money. 80% of what you pay goes to the driver. If Uber cuts that out, there's a reason why Uber has hired a lot of people to work on self-driving vehicles. So, I mean, I think this is definitely going to happen. And I think it will have quite dramatic implications. I mean, for things like insurance will get a lot cheaper. These will be self-insured fleets. Retail auto insurance will pretty much evaporate. And a lot of insurance agents out there. Curiously, there'll be a lot less need for emergency room doctors and nurses because there'll be fewer accidents. I mean, there are enormous numbers of people are injured every year, quite apart from those who are killed. I think, and no one wants to talk about this, I think there will be a collapse in the auto manufacturing industry. I mean, presently, a typical family car, your family car, is used between 3 and 5% of the time. 95, 97% of the time, it sits there rotting outside your house. Your, you know, second biggest investment after your home and all that, it just sits there rotting. Now, no one's going to want to buy cars except extremely wealthy people or odd people if you can get an Uber without a driver to your door, you know, within a minute or two. That whole economy. Now, so let's just say you got half the car manufacturing disappears. I mean, you know, the auto industry is the driver of every one of the Western economies. So I think there are huge disruptions ahead, and I think we've got to start looking at them.
It's interesting that we tend to focus on self-driving cars, whereas you've got Elon Musk with Tesla, you've got Volvo, you've got Ford, you've got GM, who have all been putting a considerable amount of money into self-driving trucks, just to take the first industry that you mentioned, because that's the first obvious target. You're talking about vehicles that are going relatively slow, that take the same path over and over, that spend most of their time on the freeways and the highways where it is easier to have a self-driving vehicle. And I think you're right there. And that is ripe for disruption. And yet you did bring out that example of the AFL-CIO. And I think that's a very nice comparison to the reluctance to talk about this disruption among not just business leaders, but also political leaders. Why is it that you see such, I won't even say pushback, but a desired ignorance of this change? Because they have to see it. They're not foolish people. They're not stupid people. They can see that we're increasing our ability to replace these types of jobs. So why is there such a reluctance to speak about it?
Well, I think one reason is that people obviously do not like facing things that are unpalatable. People don't like bad news. None of us likes bad news. And we tend to push it to the back of our minds. And I think this is a tragedy for leadership in any organization, any industry, any sector of the economy. I mean, we need leaders who will face up to the possibility things are going to get difficult and make some sort of provision for it. I think also it's a complex question because, I mean, one reason why you know, I put my sort of head on the block and began talking about some of these things. I mean, I'm no great expert. I'm not a labor market economist. I'm not a sort of technology expert in this field and so on. But it involves a lot of different fields. It involves economics. It involves obviously all sorts of workplace issues. It involves the technologies behind this, and there are many technologies involved here. And people are reluctant to talk about things that they can't claim to be the experts on. And I think one thing we're going to need much more in the 21st century, oddly, is people who can work across different fields. You know, a little bit about economics, and a little bit about politics, and a little bit about engineering, and a little bit about the various things, because these disruptive technologies increasingly will deliver changes that will cut right across the sort of social fabric and right across our lives. And I think this is going to be the biggest one we're facing now. And nobody, I mean, there's nobody there who is an expert on all of these things and can claim to be the top thinker. I mean, what interests me is I've talked about these things with economists. I mean, I sat down with a room full of economists in the World Bank a couple of years ago and talked about this, and was waiting for someone to shout me down and say, "You aren't an economist. How dare you raise these questions?" And they basically saying back to me, "You know, yes, we're worried about these things, and we're very glad you're beginning to address them, because we've all got to talk about them." So, I mean, it seems to me that the notion that expertise is required to resolve this issue makes it complicated, because it spans so many different fields. But what's also interesting is, if you do go to economists, I mean, well, who have been the great economists, the most influential economists? Obviously, Adam Smith was the Ur economist, the guy who really set up a way of understanding the operations of capital finance. Although, interestingly, of course, he locked it very much into a cultural, social context that many of those who say they his disciples don't recognize. They haven't read the 1,000 pages of his big book. But then you get, for example, David Ricardo, who was perhaps the most influential economist of the 19th century, and who was the originator of the theory of comparative advantage, which is basically behind globalization. And David Ricardo was there during the Industrial Revolution in England, and he agreed with the Luddites. He says, basically, this is going to be terrible, that there really are going to be huge problems here. And he said, however, other countries will do this, and so there's no point in our not doing it. I'm summarizing him here, but that's pretty much what he says. And then you fast forward 100 years, and you get John Maynard Keynes, who was without question the most influential economist of the 20th century. And Keynes wrote a little essay back in 1930, in which he, I think, coined the term technological unemployment. And he foresaw a time when people would only have to work 15 hours a week, because they only could work 15 hours a week, when capital had taken over the role of labor as a factor of production across much of the economy. He was talking about this. And with his tongue in his cheek, he talks about the rise of a new leisured class. You know, at the time when there were lots of leisured, you know, ladies and gentlemen of leisure who had private resources, he says there'll be a new leisured class. In other words, the long-term unemployed, because these people will not be able to get jobs. And he says at one point, you know, that something like for the working man, nothing is as sweet as the end of the day until the end of the day, because people don't know how to use their time. And I think the biggest issue this is raising for all of us, and Keynes looks at this interestingly as an economist, is how people will use their time. And I think we're very bad. We've been schooled, not least by the industrial economy, into the notion that you have a job, and the job defines how you spend your time, and you're recovering from it, you're training for it, you're preparing for it, you're retiring from it finally, and the job defines you. And so people who lose their jobs, it isn't just that they may haven't got enough money. Some people have plenty of money when they're executives who lose their jobs often have plenty of cash stashed away, but their lives still fall apart. And I think the biggest challenge of the 21st century is going to be how we use our time. Because one way or another, even if it's not as dramatic as it might be if jobs collapse, we're going to have a lot more time on our hands. And we have trained ourselves in a way that is focused on being prepared only to spend that time working.
This was my favorite part of your talk and of the book. And that is to look at the history of the development of technology and tools within humanity, how we've always seen technology and the development of better tools as a way to do more things, do things better, do things more quickly. But we're rapidly approaching, or maybe we've even passed in a few areas, that point at which the technology, the tools that we've built, now do the job better than we do, better than we can do. And so this technologically advanced future has two possibilities. One, and you've alluded to both of these, one is a future in which we need not work, and the other is a future in which we cannot work. That's that technological unemployment. So what's the difference? How do you direct towards one or the other? You did mention education, and I think I'm absolutely with you on this. I think our education right now is it's geared towards making more workers. It's geared towards preparing us for a job so we can get employment. What would we have to change to make it so that the educational system that we use, the education system that we all go through, doesn't make more workers but makes more rounded people who need to get ready for lots of hours in which they don't have to work?
Well, isn't that a great question? I was very struck. I spoke about this some years ago at a meeting. I forget which one it was, in fact, but a young woman, a student, came up to me at the end of the meeting, and she said to me, "Are you saying that our education system needs to prepare us for the fact that when I graduate and I'm 22, I retire?" And I think she captured this perfectly by saying that. And even if we are not expecting that to happen tomorrow afternoon, I think we have our education system needs to prepare people as if that were the case. And I think I'm very concerned, and I wrote a column about this recently, I'm very concerned about the fact that the main response we've had within government and educational circles to this rising impact of AI, robotics on the economy is STEM. You know, this little phrase, acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math. We need to have more STEM. Our schools, our colleges, more STEM. Everybody has to become a STEM expert. You've all got to become technologists. Train everyone to code. Now, one level, I mean, I see the truth in that, in that people need to be familiar with these things and be able to work the machines and negotiate the relation of machines and people and so on. And it's also the case that we have gaps. We need people to do a lot of technology jobs, which we don't have enough workers for at the moment, and there are big gaps in preparation. But if you're looking in the longer term, the notion that in 25 years' time, that the people, everyone will want to get jobs in STEM, I think is ridiculous. Because all the lower-level jobs precisely will be done by machines. I mean, the things which machines can do most easily are things in science, technology, engineering, and math. They find it more difficult to do things involving people and animals, you know, and the arts and culture and all sorts of other things. Entrepreneurship. Machines don't do entrepreneurship. These are the areas where we need to be strengthening our education. I mean, I have 5 children, 13 grandchildren, and, you know, insofar as they're interested, I do talk to them about these things from time to time. And I say, well, you know, what kind of jobs are they going to be in 20, 25 years' time? And it seems to me the low-level technology type jobs we have now are going to be among the first ones to go. And so we're forced back on this question, which you raised precisely, and which this young woman raised after my speech, of how does education prepare you for life? Now, this sounds like a cliche, but for an awful long time, we've justified education as workforce preparation. And it seems to me at least as important as that has to be the context preparing people for not work. And I can go back, I mean, the historical examples of this back before women were mainly involved with the workforce. Women's education was really somewhat different, and there was a focus there on culture, on the arts, because back when women became housewives, and I'm not suggesting that was a good situation, but it was our culture in the West for a long time that certainly women in the middle classes did not typically have careers, and they found fulfilling lives doing other things. I think there are various taproots to our understanding of how we might reconfigure our notion of how we use time by looking at communities of people who have used time well without, you know, the workday and reward for labor being at the center of it. But I certainly think as we look to redesign our education system, STEM is all very well. Short term, we certainly need more STEM workers. Long term, we've all got to understand how this stuff goes, although we pick it up intuitively. You know, I mean, you and I are old enough to remember the days when you got manuals, when you got a new program on your machine. Now we don't get a manual. It's intuitive. You work out how it works. We all know a bit about how these things go. We ask our friends. We Google it. There's this whole notion of formal preparation for the basic use of technology, of course, is now out of date. And I think the context has to be one of the humanities, liberal arts, to prepare people to be able to live and at the same time to work and to engage with technology when necessary. And I'd be very happy to hear a speech from one of our political or educational leaders setting that out, because I think that's what we need. 21st century, going back to the point you raised earlier, you know, my saying, is a 21st century all about machines and our essentially approximating ourselves to machines, are trying to be as good as the machines, trying to outpace the machines, or is it all about us and the incredible, incredible good news that we've now found a way to devise machines that can enable us to live better and more fulfilled human lives? And I think the next few years will determine which way we go.
It's interesting that you mentioned that STEM, which here in the studio, we find particularly interesting and we find it exciting that we are pushing more young people into those fields. But you're right. Those STEM fields will be the first fields that get replaced. As we build smarter and smarter tools, they will create more jobs, but those jobs aren't going to be filled by humans. They're going to be filled by the tools that do better jobs than humans. And yet, at the core of this entire discussion, this is this idea that education prepares us to be workers. And I know, because I come from an academic background, I know there are people, there are grad students, there are undergraduates who are going to rankle at that suggestion because they don't see themselves as being prepared to work, even though that's what they say when I ask them why they're at university. They think they're being prepared for a larger view of the world. But how would you structure education? If I could tell someone, look, you're not going to have to work unless you want to. You're not going to have to get a job. You're not going to have to support yourself because we're going to have machines that do all that. What does a society like that look like? Because what you've just suggested, although it sounds wonderful to have free time to improve myself and improve the world around me, it removes what a lot of people think is the goal. And the goal is to support yourself, support your family, raise your children and your grandchildren, make sure that they have enough to eat, make sure that they're taken care of. If I suddenly pull that away and say that's no longer the goal is to make better people, that doesn't compute. That I have no frame of reference. So how do I give that to people who have no frame of reference?
I think one of the clues here is in this issue of the use of time, which Keynes refers to in that 1930 essay of his. And I mean, he's basically saying that, you know, ordinary folk don't know how to use their time and they get bored. And of course, now they watch TV or they drink or, you know, he's making that kind of point. And of course, but it isn't just ordinary folk, if you like. It's people, you know, people at all levels of society, all levels of education and cultural attainment, and indeed all levels of economic economic opportunity. Not very many of them are very good at using their time when they haven't got structure. So, I mean, if you're a wealthy person doesn't need to work, typically you'll get yourself onto boards of organizations, museums and orchestras and or charities. And, you know, I mean, Bill Gates and his wife, very interestingly, I mean, he ends up not running his company and deciding to become a philanthropist and give away a lot of his money, and sets up this huge organization based out in Seattle to do that. So he's just as busy as he was back then. I mean, how people cope, very few, you know, I mean, think about this yourself. I mean, I you know, what happens if you spend, you find yourself with days on end with nothing to do, nothing formal, structured to do. Now, of course, those in religious traditions, I mean, particularly within the Catholic tradition and within Buddhism and some others, there's a lot of focus here on meditation, on cultivating the inner life. And that's one way of reframing this discussion. But I think as a public question, I think if our educational leaders focused on these twin objectives, preparing people to be able to manage in a technologically driven society, fine. Some of them are specialists, some of them are high-level experts with STEM at the center of their lives, many at a lower level with, you know, some ability to deal with these things as necessary. If you're taking care of old people and you've got to deal with the machines that are helping you take care of the old people. But in parallel with that, and just as important, is preparing people so they can spend a weekend when nothing is happening on their own. And they haven't got screens. They can't just binge Netflix and so on. I mean, that preparing people to be able to spend time alone, maybe with books, maybe with, you know, they can paint. But these traditional, if you like, analog activities become the option. And I think if you can't address both those things at the same time, you probably shouldn't be running an education system, because I think they're going to be both equally important to the 21st century. And the big push now towards STEM is a step backwards.
We are speaking with Dr. Nigel Cameron. He is the technology and futures editor at hunherd.com. And we're speaking about the disruption, not just of our workforce, but also of our societies. We'll be right back. We'll return once more to our interview, but first let's take another moment to thank a sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, let me ask you something. Did you like your last mortgage process? I mean, what's not to like, right? You get a banker's box full of old receipts and pay stubs. You bring it into a bank with some rando who's going to decide whether or not you're worthy of a loan. No, thank you. That's a horrible, horrible experience. What you need is something that's been updated, something that's from the digital era, something that keeps up with the times. What you need is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, the mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. No more box of crinkly old pieces of paper. It's a digital world. We need a digital solution. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And then with those calculations, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply. Understand fully. Mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Triangulation. Dr. Cameron, you mentioned this idea that STEM is heading in the wrong direction. And in your talk and in your book, you also mentioned that there's an upheaval waiting to happen in our educational system across the Western world. In fact, I think you made the prediction that eventually we won't have the need for universities. We won't have the need for the educational system that exists today. What is that based on? I mean, you're an academic. This is what you work in. Why would you predict the demise of your own industry?
Well, there are two or three different questions coming together here. I mean, one is the way in which in much of the West, particularly North America is in the lead here, education as an industry is pricing itself out of a job. I mean, there have been huge increases in tuition in terms of student loans, and that whole thing just really isn't working. And aside from some of the other issues we're discussing, plainly there's a collapse awaiting North American higher education. Elite institutions will survive because people will have the funding, or they will have the funding to continue. But most institutions are getting just too expensive for what they're delivering. And at the same time, technology is coming along. I mean, the hot thing a few years ago was what are called MOOCs, M-O-O-C, Massive Open Online Courses, which are AI-driven courses, so they can take on an extra student. It doesn't cost any more money. So you can have 5 students, or you could have literally a million students, and the costs are basically the same for the institution. And you do it yourself. I mean, you get all sorts of stuff coming to you digitally, and that's how you learn. And there was a thought that MOOCs would sort of knock the education system on its head, and it hasn't happened, although major institutions are using MOOCs for certain purposes. There are 1 or 2 graduate programs available that are based on MOOCs. Obviously, it's easier to teach technology than it is to teach literature using a MOOC, but you can still do these things. And certainly with the advance in virtual reality and augmented reality, I think there will be teaching methods coming out of these digital systems, which are very sophisticated. I mean, presently, you know, people have done correspondence courses, you know, for 150 years. And it's very difficult to do a correspondence course. And much of what the internet offered in the way of education over the last 30 years has basically been the old correspondence course done online. and you're not particularly motivated. You're on your own sitting there studying. You haven't got buddies around you. You haven't got a social context for what you're learning. You can't ask questions directly of a teacher. It's all done, you know, through typing. This is going to get a lot more sophisticated. And it seems to me an awful lot cheaper. And it seems to me it'll be wonderful if you can be in an African country with very limited resources around you. Already you can get a smartphone there very, very cheaply. A lot of smartphones now, mobile, of course, is driving much of the African economy. And you can sit there and you can tune into MIT and do a program there. This is already beginning to be possible. We'll see a lot more of that. It'll be a lot cheaper, a lot more diverse. So that's happening anyway. And I think our education system, sadly, is going to feel in the brunt. I mean, I wouldn't advise anyone now to go and do a PhD planning to be teaching in a college. Seems to me that there will be elite teachers required for the Ivy Leagues and so on. People will be sitting in cubicles writing curriculum for these new delivery systems. But I think the notion there'll be tens of thousands of jobs out there for mid-level academics, very fulfilling jobs they have been for many people. I think that's going to be under a lot of threat. But in terms of content, I think it's this notion of producing a new kind of generalist, that there will still obviously be the need for specialists in all sorts of areas. But I think the U.S. liberal arts system, which is very unlike systems in Europe and elsewhere, I think has enormous advantage here, because the idea has always been there that you need to be some sort of generalist in order to be an effective specialist. And I think we need to strengthen that notion. And the idea that STEM should somehow take it over, or that you should get, you know, more of a focus just on business or just on anything in particular, needs to be modified by a continued and upgraded focus on the liberal arts. Because ultimately, it's the liberal arts that enable people to live. I mean, this is really this combination of subjects and disciplines with a particular focus in the humanities, in literature. And of course, also in the arts themselves, these are the things that give our lives human distinctiveness. And yes, we need technology, and we have to be able to manage technology and work with technology. But I think for most people, I mean, if you're on your own for the weekend and the TV's broken down and your phone is broke, and you're there with, you know, what do? You've got books, you've got paper, maybe you've got pencils. You can write and think. You can read. And maybe you can cook. And I think these things are going to become more and more important to us. And not because we deny the technologies, but just because we are going to be recovering our notion of the distinctively human experience. We'll transcend the current obsession with playing with our devices all the time, and education has to prepare us for it. I'll just throw in one more thing. I mean, quite apart from the jobs being taken by robots, there may or may not be a new job, we just don't know, we're all going to live longer. I mean, a lot longer. Just saw a statistic the other day, a boy born in England this year is expected to live, there's a 50% chance he'll live till he's 103.
Wow.
Now, I don't know how they make those predictions, 103 years time. But the point is, you know, back in the old days when they introduced Social Security in the US, people were typically dying before they could collect it. Now, we're all hoping to be around into our 80s and 90s, even those of us of sort of our sort of, you know, age. And kids born today may well live till they're well into their hundreds. And you know, this is going to mean you're going to have 30, 40 years of post-work experience ahead of you, even if you have a traditional job. And preparing for that, I think, is something education has to take on board.
It's interesting because in my circles, my religious order runs 28 colleges and universities in the United States, dozens more across the world. And we've had our own internal discussions about this for going on 20 years now. We see the trend that, you know, we will not have 28 colleges and universities in maybe a decade. And we will be turning over some of our universities to our lay collaborators and perhaps shutting others down because of what you're describing. There is this disconnect right now between what universities were created to do and what they are doing. Universities were supposed to be places of higher learning where people come to become more generalist, become better rounded. They've become training centers. People go to university not because they want to be a more educated person, but because they need those letters at the end of their name to get the job that they really want. And of course, all of our guys who have dedicated their lives to education, they look at that and they say, wait a minute. If that's what you want, if you want a job, you don't go to a college or a university. You go to a trade school. You go to a vocational school. That's what those are for. And they see the implosion of the education system as it is coming at some point in the near future. I love to tie that in with how you see the disruption in society by smart AI, how that might actually accelerate it. Now, in your ideal world, you described a little bit of it. In your ideal world where people don't have to work, where they have more time of leisure, where the educational system has been reformatted so that it forms them more as people who are ready to be generalists in the world, what does a university system look like? Or does it just go away entirely?
Well, I think another sort of cliche which has been in vogue in recent years is lifelong learning. And I think it needs to be refurbished, because I think we will plainly be looking to educational centers to resource us as we go through our long lives and as we move in and out of jobs and as we have perhaps extended retirement. And that you know, it wouldn't just be going back to do a sort of night school course in something. I think these will become institutions which we move into and out of rather naturally at different points in our lives, and into and out of physically and also digitally, depending on how the courses are being offered. And I certainly think there's a competitive advantage issue there for schools who begin to prepare themselves. What if people start retiring when they're 40 rather than 65 or whatever it is now? What kind of needs will they have? What kind of opportunities? I mean, it isn't just that they'll want to be taught how to play golf, and pick up a hobby. It's that perhaps they'll need to be refreshed in their whole understanding of the human experience, of literature, of history, civilization, culture. I think it's going to fragment like that. I think that, I feel like there'll be new markets there for institutions that will, I think, lose market students at the beginning. You're right about trades. There's a piece, was it in Time or Newsweek or something 3 or 4 years ago, about how all the millionaires are plumbers and electricians. I mean, it's amazing the number of tradespeople who work on their own or work with a couple of colleagues, and they squirrel the money away and they get well paid, and they have jobs that are quite difficult to replace with machines, and the big corporations don't have much of an advantage in doing, because they involve local skilled people who are on the ground. And in that case, maybe we should all want to be plumbers. Certainly the question of the jobs that will survive the impact of the AI detonation is a very interesting one. The one thing I know is that the mid to low level job will not be STEM type jobs. But conversely, I think our schools can need to be reconfiguring themselves so that they will be accessible throughout our lives. And this whole notion that you have this great rush for education at the beginning, take on huge amounts of debt often in the process, and then spend your life doing the job, paying down the debt. I think that is a 20th century model. And the new models that we're going to be working with are going to be actually much more interesting if we can be innovative in our thinking about them.
Dr. Cameron, during your TED Talk, you made a statement that you kind of went quickly past it, but I'd love to flesh it out. You said income in this new disrupted future wouldn't have to be a direct relation to the work that you do. What does that mean?
Well, within the industrial economy of the last 100, 200 years as it's been developing, you can get a job, you go to work, you're paid a certain amount of money. Some tax is taken off that. Governments in different ways provide some social benefits or transfers to poorer people or people who haven't got jobs. But the basic model is you go out, you work, you earn some money. And at different levels, you can be wealthy or you can be poor, but you can be having a full-time job. Now, I think that pattern is plainly going to shift. Let us say that we have 30% or 50% less work in the economy. Keynes' assumption was 15 hours a week rather than, back in his day, probably 45 or 50 will be a full-time. So we lose a third or two-thirds of the job opportunities and requirements. So what happens, first of all, to the money? If you assume that the economy is still maintaining itself, that is to say that production is now being transferred to machines and therefore there's just as much money being produced by the economy, value is still being maintained, governments are still getting their taxes one way or another, what happens? Do you just get paid for 15 hours? Do you have some sort of supplementation to that? And the idea that many people have floated is that of what's called basic income or universal basic income, which essentially means that when you finish school, you begin getting Social Security. That would be the best way to illustrate it. It isn't a fortune, but it's just about enough to live on. So whether it's $1,000 a month or something like that. And then you get a job as well. That's great, part-time, full-time, but you can live without it. And this idea has been pushed from, if you like, the right and the left, which one reason why it's rather intriguing. Milton Friedman, great conservative economist, was very keen on this. I don't think he used that term for it. Saw it more in terms of tax credits. But the basic idea has appealed to many conservative thinkers like Charles Murray, whom I mentioned a little earlier. And the idea they have is that you take all the money we now hand out in welfare benefits and you basically put it into one pot and give everyone the same. And it therefore doesn't have to cost you any more money, but you create a situation where people can move in and out of work much more readily. Now, of course, there are problems there because that would be pulling money back from certain special groups of people like the blind and the handicapped and so on, but to divide it up equally. On the left, it's a more extravagant proposition in that what they would say is you maintain many of the current social benefits, but you add this layer of giving everybody kind of social security from the get-go. I think it's an important idea. I'm not myself a total fan of it, but I think it's something that we need to have at the back of our minds as we have these conversations. Other things also are going to be very important here. I was invited to a meeting with some government people in England in 10 Downing Street a little while ago, and they said, well, what do you think we should do about this? And I said, well, look at all of the distinctions we make now. I mean, full-time, part-time, paid employment, voluntary work, study and employment and retirement. There are a whole lot of little lines here we have in the landscape of people's life and their work, which have been central to the operation of the industrial economy. And I said probably every one of them, you need to sort of take an eraser and begin to sort of, make little holes in it or make it not so significant. So maybe people should be rewarded for doing what we now call voluntary work, work in the third sector, work for charities. Maybe that should be part of the package that, yes, you still work 35 hours a week, but you can divide us between the traditional paid employment and working for the community. And there's a system whereby you get reimbursed for this. So you aren't idle, but you're also doing useful things. Maybe we should bring back national service of a kind. I think that has enormous appeal. Some of the European countries still do this. So if you can't get a job when you leave college, maybe you can straight away get 3 years government-funded service, not necessarily military, could be civil service. We need to think creatively about these things where we've had pretty rigid distinctions in the past. And there's another idea which I've argued, which is that we should also use the retirement age as a kind of governor here, as a way to keep control of the jobs that are available. I probably rather do this than I will give everybody a pension when they leave college, because I think it's important to maintain career structures. Younger people need to have job experience, even if it finishes earlier than it has done in the past. So, I mean, currently, for Social Security, full retirement is 66. I think it's 66. And it's around that in most countries. What if the government were to push that down or were have an option to push it down? If there were fewer jobs in the economy, they could put it down to 56 or down to 46. And then they could raise it again if new jobs became available. And they could find ways to encourage private sector retirement to follow the pattern using taxes and so on. So, I mean, I think there are various ways in which governments can respond to the notion people all need to be paid for something, and there may be less actual traditional work to be done. And those are the discussions we need to have in our presidential debates next time around, rather than the ones that dominated last time, because these would be forward-looking discussions. And I think the scope there for lots of different opinions. And I'd love to have four or five good options out there for coping with a situation in which, say, you had one-third fewer actual jobs, and you still wanted to maintain the fabric of people's motivation and keep them involved, give them opportunities to do useful things all day long. I don't hear politicians talking about these things much at all.
It's interesting because at the same time, I see all the benefits of this. Essentially, what you're talking about is the question that we get when we're in high school and we're talking to a guidance counselor for the first time. And that is, if you didn't have to worry about income, if you had the $1 million or the $1 billion or whatever it would be now, what would you do? Because ultimately, that makes a better person and a better world. Not what will you do in order to pay the bills, but what would you like to do? What do you think would make you a more complete person? And so on that hand, I'm absolutely behind this. I love it. I love the idea. On the other hand, and I think this is where you're going to get the pushback, although people may like the idea of this guaranteed income, of being able to live and then seek your perfection, it changes the goalpost of what we think success is. Because success right now in the developed world is you get educated, you get a good job, you build up enough of a stash of cash so that you can retire and do what you want, which is oddly what we're suggesting that they do from the beginning. They don't like the idea. Wait, let me take that away. We don't like the idea that we might work and slave and put our blood, sweat, and tears into something. And here's someone else who hasn't done what we think is a commensurate level of work, and they're getting the same style of life. That pushes us. It pushes the unfair button. How do you get people to not see this as a case of I'm allowing everyone else to live on my coattails?
Well, it seems to me we need to find solutions that work in our culture. I think Europeans have a lot less problem with this sort of thing than Americans do, which is one reason why socialism is a kind of positive word in much of Europe, and it's a negative word here. But I think we need to come up with a model that works. So as I was suggesting, if, for example, you still had to work 35 hours a week, and you could, but you could do what we now call voluntary work. You know, you could work in a thrift store, you know, or you could be, you know, visiting elderly people. You could be doing all sorts of cleanups and all sorts of real activity as part of your package, even if only 15 hours of what you were doing was actually being traditionally remunerated. I think in that situation, people would have far less concern. They say, well, people actually are getting out there working. They've got things to do all day long. And we've divided up the actual traditional paid employment so that everyone gets a fair crack at it. And young people get more of it to do because it's more demanding. And I think there are models of that kind that we can work with. I mean, plainly, there are lazy people out there. And there aren't actually, I think most of us know, there aren't actually very many people out there who are lazy. Most people like to be employed. They like to have something to do. Of course, the sadness is here in the States, particularly, is the tragedy of the working poor. In that, I mean, there are many people out there, you know, who are working two and three jobs. And they're paying enormous amounts of money just to travel to and from these jobs compared to their income. And they're in a very difficult situation, and they're trying to raise kids. And, I mean, my experience is that there aren't a lot of people around who would rather be on welfare. There are experiments being done about universal income in some European countries to see if it really makes a difference to people's motivation. I would be surprised if it made a big difference. Most people like to have something to do, and they find significance in what they do, and they have friends there, get them out of the house. I don't think that's going to be a big problem. I think the bigger problem is how people are going to spend increased amounts of leisure time if they find it sort of dumped on them. And so one thing, I mean, just off the top of my head, if I were running a school at any level, I would maybe require everyone to spend time doing nothing every day. You know, I would have little projects for people to, well, maybe they can get together with one or two friends, but they can't use screens and they often things they can't do. And they have to learn to be on their own. They have to learn to be able to read, learn to be quiet, learn to cope with being bored. And I think that forces us back on the human question, on how we deal with our mortality, how we deal with the fact that, you know, we're going to have less mortality because we're all going to live longer. How we cope with the fact. But I mean, you know, Keynes put it very well. He said, you know, the working man, when he goes home, looks forward to knocking off at the end of the day more than anything else, and knocks off and then he's bored. And that, I think, is a nut we have to crack. And I think that should be at least as big a focus of what we're doing in our education as preparing people to have the technical skills that they will also need.
I think that is a great place to end the interview. This idea of not being a working person, but being a person who's working. And it really changes the idea of what we consider success in society. And maybe makes us a little less afraid of the coming technologies. Dr. Cameron, I want to thank you so very much for being with us on Triangulation. If you could you tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find your work, and where they can find your next speaking engagement?
Well, thank you very much. Yes. I'm now spending half of my time working with this website based in the UK, although it's moving to the US also next year, called Unheard. Think herd of cows. Our little model is a mad cow. Against the Herd, UNHERD .com. And you can find me there. You can email me there. I'm happy to be in touch with anybody. Yes, you'll see at the bottom there, we have this long piece we've just produced on Mark Zuckerberg and his quest for the presidency. Apparently, he's quite keen now to move into the White House, and we look at that as one of the hot issues with some rather funny cartoons. And my next speaking engagement, that is actually quite a good question, because I just gave a rather lengthy lecture a couple of days ago. So I'll have to get back. I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't know where I'm speaking next, but I'm certainly speaking to you now.
Indeed, Dr. Cameron. Again, it has been an absolute pleasure. Fascinating material. I advise everyone who can to go out and either get a book or the ebook equivalent of "Will Robots Take Your Job?" It's a wonderful dive into a future that we don't really understand, but we can either embrace or be afraid of. Again, thank you for being our guest here on Triangulation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Triangulation. Don't forget that we do the show live every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific time. You could always watch us at live.twit.tv, or you could just go to our show page at twit.tv/triangulation. There you'll find all of our back episodes as well as show notes about the various guests that we have profiled here on the show. And please drop by twit.tv to find all of our tech programming. I'm Father Robert Ballas here, the Digital Jesuit, saying thank you and goodbye from Triangulation.